and welcome to Worlds Apart. On the eve of the record-setting phone call between President Putin and President Trump, Western media were awash with statements about the geopolitical ball being in the Kremlin's court. How did the two leaders play it, and are they and their teams playing the same game? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jack Rasmus, author of The Neoliberal Scourge and professor of economics at St. Mary's College. Professor Rasmus, it's great talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, I know you've been following the U.S.-Russia exchanges pretty closely, and there is a definite change in not just the tone, but I think the underlying structure of diplomacy. It seems to be much less geared towards easy, public relation goals, and more technical, more focused on the long-lasting or perhaps medium-lasting outcomes. What's your impression of it so far?
I think the Trump administration realizes it has to orient its foreign policy towards the BRICS, and that means create some new relationship with both Russia and China at the core of the BRICS. That's the main challenge to the U.S. global economic empire. It's not this neocon proxy war in Ukraine. In fact, that's draining the U.S. Treasury and raising the cost of empire. I've been writing recently and talking quite a bit about how we should see the general picture of what's going on here as the U.S. attempting to restructure its global economic relationships. It's a fundamental change. It's not personal interest of Donald Trump. The empire as structured economically is increasingly unaffordable. The U.S. is throwing away hundreds of billions of dollars, not only in Ukraine, but who knows how many hundreds of billions in NATO. And that's just not the key to the U.S. Imperial structure anymore. There are serious threats and challenges, particularly the BRICS. And we see just lately with talk about the dollar going down and so forth by Commerce Secretary Bessent. So that's really what's behind all this.
Well, it may be behind all of this, and we will definitely look at the big picture as well. But let's start with the case in point, because you have to start somewhere. And it seems that the Trump administration is starting with the most obvious black hole that is siphoning the American treasury out. Now, we've just had this record phone call between Putin and Trump, which lasted for 2.5 hours, which is a record in and of itself. Aren't you surprised by the length? Because we keep hearing from the American media that Trump attention spans cannot last longer than 5 minutes. And here you have the two leaders discussing their very testy relationship for several hours.
Well, that 5 minutes, that's just mainstream media propaganda. So, you can disregard that. The U.S. Is looking at restructuring its relationship with Russia along a lot of lines. That the Ukraine, finding a solution to the Ukraine war is only one. There's a lot of, I'm sure, discussions going on a whole range of economic and political relationships here. What they really represents as far as Ukraine is there will be a bilateral deal eventually between the U.S. and Russia on Ukraine. The U.S. will leave the proxy role it's been playing in that war. U.S. will settle with Russia, whether Europe likes it or not. In the beginning of the end of the U.S. involvement in the war, but I fear we're seeing the beginning of the beginning of the Europeans taking over that conflict. So the war itself may not end, but the U.S. involvement in it will end.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I think both the Kremlin and the White House issued their statements today supporting what you've been just saying, that, they do see the Ukrainian question as the current focal point within a much broader framework of their relationship. And both, by the way, have stressed that they share special responsibility in terms of providing global security. That's quite remarkable to hear from Washington, that this responsibility is actually shared with another nation. Now, how important is that in your view, stating in plain language for everybody to hear that as testy as it is, this relationship doesn't start and doesn't end with Ukraine?
Yes, well, you know, the problem with the Biden administration was they were on a road to more direct conflict with Russia. That was inevitable. Things were just slipping in that direction. And, you know, a lot of folks were being seriously concerned that where this would lead. And the next step, of course, would be deeper American military involvement and European involvement. The Trump administration has backed off of that and said, hey, you know, is that in the interest of the United States or anybody in the world to have this conflict between two nuclear powers? The neocons in the U.S. were even talking about, well, you know, we can win a tactical nuclear war as if that were possible. So, you know, we're coming back from the brink, I think, here with the Trump administration, which, you know, has to be recognized. But there's a long way back from that. The Biden administration had gotten us deeply involved in that almost inextricably. And now the retreat and is going to be a long, hard roll, I think, of negotiations.
Now, you said that there is a long way back, but this way has to start somewhere. And the current format of the talks, just Moscow and Washington sorting it out between themselves, it is abhorred in Europe, obviously, and in Ukraine as well, but it does have its certain advantages as far as efficiency goes, because it's much harder to torpedo bilateral talks, as happened with previous rounds of talks on the Ukrainian issue, for example, in Istanbul 3 years ago. And it's also, it should be easier to implement any agreements that are reached if the two sides are genuinely committed to it. Now, do you see that commitment in place?
Yes, I see the Trump administration committed to some kind of arrangement, new relationships, and getting the U.S. out of supporting Ukraine in the war. But you got to remember, there's a lot of political interests in Washington that are pushing in the other direction. And it's not going to be easy road, as I said, because, you know, the mainstream media, the Democrat Party, a certain wing of the U.S. elite simply wanted to continue and still does, and will try to find some ways to sabotage as we go. It's kind of a dangerous period, you know. Will the neocons who are still there, right, deep in the Democrat Party, will they be able to thwart the negotiations? We'll see.
Now, speaking about sabotage, one practical outcome of this phone call is a partial ceasefire, the agreement to suspend attacks, active attacks on energy infrastructure, as well as, maritime attacks in the Black Sea. And from what I know, this idea was initially floated by Zelensky himself. He suggested that to the Europeans. The Europeans tried to suggest it to Trump. And at the end, it was Putin who ultimately proposed that to Trump, and the two leaders agreed on that. But a few hours later, we hear about the Ukrainian drones attacking a Russian oil pumping station. And not just a Russian oil pumping station, this station was sort of maintaining and helping to keep in operation the whole pipeline that primarily transports Kazakh oil that is produced by European and American companies. So this is a very peculiar and very surprising, I would say, choice of a target by the Ukrainians. What do you think? What kind of a message do you think they were trying to send? And most importantly, to whom?
Well, the European Ukraine Zelensky proposal for ceasefire was really different than what's been proposed by Putin here. They're not the same thing.
They're not the same, but at least in Moscow, this proposal by Putin to, implement a partial ceasefire and to stop striking the energy targets is seen as a gesture of goodwill that Moscow is willing to extend not only to Washington, but also to its proxy in Kyiv.
Yeah, well, Putin gave Trump something to take back. He had to, you know, give him something to work with. And that partial ceasefire on infrastructure was really what he gave him to keep the negotiations ball going forward. And Trump has responded to it as such. That's kind of a slow initial step. You know, both sides got to show good faith in terms of concessions here as they continue negotiations. But we should make no mistake that Zelensky has now aligned himself with the Europeans. He will give, talk to agreeing with Trump here, because if he doesn't, everything will get cut off, the intelligence and the satellites and Starlink and everything. So he'll give, verbal agreement to Trump, but he's really following the Europeans, who really want to continue the war. The Europeans think if they continue for another year that the Russian effort is going to collapse. I mean, it's nonsense. But Zelensky's going to play both sides, and he's going to—he's very unreliable. You can't believe whatever he says, as Trump has found out. He will play both ends against the middle. And I think you're going to see provocations by Ukraine here. Negotiations continue.
I see. Now, Professor Rasmus, you have written recently about the way the Ukrainian side has been trying to play Trump and perhaps be even bigger Trump than Trump himself with the mineral deal, proposing one thing and trying to get something else. Now, do you think Washington at this point has enough leverage to ensure that either the partial ceasefire can be upheld or that its proxy in Kyiv, can be trusted to do what's required and be less of a saboteur at this point?
Well, a lot depends on whether Zelensky thinks he can get the Europeans to step in and play the American role. You know, that's the big problem I see in the negotiations. The Europeans are not on board for good reason. they've been excluded from all the discussions and negotiations because the negotiations cover a lot larger scope, not just Ukraine. And there's no reason for them to be involved. And they would probably use the information to try to sabotage the negotiations anyway. And the same goes for Zelensky in Ukraine. That's why they've been kept out of the negotiations correctly, I think. What Zelensky does depends upon what the Europeans do. And they look like they're hell-bent on continuing the war, raising $1 trillion to continue fighting the war. How they're going to do that is another interesting question. In any event, that's the big stick in the mud here, the European position, and it's enabling Zelensky to play both sides against the middle, and it's only dragging out the issue. I think at some point, the bilateral negotiations between Russia and the U.S. will have to just conclude on their own, and the U.S. totally get out, and then the Europeans will be left holding the bag and see what they can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you what we are going to do right now. We are going to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jack Rasmus, author of The Neoliberal's Courage and professor of economics at St. Mary's College. Now, Professor Rasmus, you mentioned in another interview that over the last 3 years, Ukraine has become a sort of black hole in terms of its sponsors' money being spent and in terms of people being killed. But if we cut through all this rhetorical tapestry, what Zelensky insists upon is it's essentially keeping this black hole in place. And when he asks for security guarantees, ultimately he's asking for resources to be thrown into that black hole. Now, what I want to ask you is, why do you think he's so tied to this goal? Because one could see many other far more efficient ways for him to extricate himself from this predicament and perhaps even, you know, get certain advantages both from the Europeans, from the Americans, from the Russians. Why do you think he's so banned on, you know, keep increasing that black hole?
Well, because I think he stays in power as long as the war continues. You know, if the war were over and they restored elections, all the polls show he would get wiped out in a fair election in Ukraine. So, yeah, he stays in power. And, of course, you know, in Ukraine, from the top all the way down, there's a lot of skimming of the money being provided by the U.S. And who knows where it's all going. And you could say the same thing about the Europeans, you know, those Europeans who are committed, the neocon version of the Europeans in the European Commission and the European Council and so forth. You know, their whole political career also depends on continuing the war, because that means the U.S. Keeps funneling money into NATO. If the U.S. leaves Ukraine, they may leave NATO. I think that's the next step. And if that happens, you know, you've got hundreds of billions of dollars that is propping up the European economy from the U.S. goes away. And that raises a big question mark about their political careers in Europe.
I think Zelensky got to the peak of his so-called international acclaim by being proxy. He's very used to that role. He's very used to being puffed up by, you know, a certain group of admirers. But up until now, it's been used primarily against Russia and Putin. Do you think there is a possibility of sort of trying to rebrand Zelensky as a proxy against Trump? And do you think he could be an effective proxy against the American president right now?
No, I think politically he's finished, in the U.S. at least. You know, he's a darling of some of the Europeans, Starmer and Macron and so forth. You know, they hug him publicly and everything. So, you know, that's
well,
where,
they hug him,
you know,
publicly, but they do not offer him much apart from very lofty rhetoric and, you know, grandiose plans about how they are going to grow the military without, you know, having enough industrial capacity to provide artillery for the current operations.
Well, they're throwing a lot of money at him still. You know, they're finding little cubby holes of funding, and they're trying to keep him afloat until they settle the issue of where they're going to get more fundamental funding to continue Ukraine. And I think, you know, they're going to have to raise some European bonds, which is a big question. Who wants to buy risky European bonds funding Ukraine? They've been trying that for over a year. They can't seem to get that bond sale going. But they're sitting on the $260 billion of Russian frozen assets. And I think eventually they're going to have to go after that if they want to fund Ukraine, unless they can raise their own private bonds. So it's a big question whether they can continue to fund it. But, you know, the Europeans are sitting on a nice pile of money there, of assets. And you got to understand.
And they have to burn through it somehow, right? Rather than spending it on their own people.
I think the way they're going to get at it is to use it to, quote, rebuild Ukraine, you see. That's how they're going to get it, or try to get it. The contrast with the U.S. is interesting. You mentioned the minerals deal. Well, I see that as an attempt for the U.S. to build a pot of money, too, to use to, quote, rebuild Ukraine afterwards. The U.S. does not have that pot. Joe Biden just threw the money at Ukraine, no strings attached, to, you know, $350 billion, and he has no pot in which to throw the money around in the rebuilding and once the settlement. The Europeans have the pot, you see. They have the $260 billion. But now that they're talking about rebuilding Ukraine, it's a sign that we're reaching the end game politically and militarily. You know, that's when they talk about, well, what are we going to do with the money afterwards, you see?
You mentioned before that American and European strategies at this point of time are diametrically opposing, both economically and perhaps geopolitically. And the strategy for the European elites for the time being is to try to wait Trump out. Perhaps they are counting on him being sort of more of an aberration than a fundamental trend. What's your take on it? Do you think there is much sense in trying to buy time? Do you think Trump is just, you know, a passing actor, or does he represent something more fundamental in the U.S. policy?
Oh, I think Trump represents something more fundamental. You see, in the last election, he broadened out his base quite a bit, minorities and working class and unions and everything. This is almost a restructuring of the U.S. political scene. Trump and a movement now, it's not just MAGA, you see, is not going to go away. And once again, I come back to my fundamental point, and that is the elites in the U.S. realize they got to make some changes globally here. The empire costs too much. They can't afford it. You know, we're running $2 trillion a year plus deficits. We got $36 trillion national debt. We're paying bondholders $1 trillion a year interest on that debt. It's unsustainable. So what they need to do is cut their costs that aren't that productive or strategic globally, and shift that saving to new weapons development and the new strategies, which is to consolidate back to the Western Hemisphere and take care of America's lake, which is called the Pacific Ocean. Europe is not that important anymore, but we're throwing lots of money at Europe. We have been. That's the old Cold War. And Trump and others have realized that, well, the Europeans have to take care of themselves from now on. And that's why they're scurrying around, the Europeans, to try to raise $1 trillion, according to Wall Street Journal, to fund their own military defense. But that doesn't happen overnight, as you say. It takes a while to convert industries, create new industries, and so forth. Europe is in a real fix, I think. And, of course, they're being ignored globally now as the U.S. focuses towards the BRICS and China and so forth. They're being excluded. They're becoming a global political backwater.
I think we would both agree that the neoliberal elites, particularly those in Europe, have used Russia for a long time as a convenient threat to do what they do. But I've also heard experts say that Trump may be interested, or may benefit at least, from using Russia as a threat in order to raise money from Europe, you know, make them increase NATO spending, you know, make them pursue more American military contracts, you know, perhaps some other financial deals. Do you think he's likely to be tempted to do that?
Well, I wrote an article before February 22, when the war erupted, that was entitled 10 Reasons Why the U.S. May Want Russia to Invade Ukraine. And at the top of that was to reestablish not only U.S. control over NATO that was slipping, but to make the Europeans more dependent on the U.S. And if you look at what's been happening in a whole line of policies, both U.S. tax policies, U.S. tariff and trade policies, and, of course, energy policies, by driving Russia out of the energy sector in Europe and out of the entire Western European economy, pretty much, the U.S. has been able, U.S. businesses, to enter into that vacuum. And it's been very profitable to the U.S. and the businesses. And across the board, you can see a whole number of ways that Europe's economy has become increasingly dependent on the U.S. And I think that was one of the goals of the whole conflict.
I think Europe is falling for its own colonial trap. And by the way, you wrote a whole book on the neoliberal ideology, calling it a scourge. But at its peak, at least it seemed a fairly functional, efficient way of exploiting the world economically and keeping it down ideologically and, I would say, psychologically. I think there are very, very few buyers for this kind of a deal right now, apart from Ukraine and some others. So my question to you now is, can neoliberalism succeed in America, in the West, without other nations underwriting it? Can it succeed on its own?
Well, neoliberalism is really a set of four policies: industrial policy, fiscal, monetary policies, and what we call external policies, you know, currency, the dollar, trade, and so forth. Since 2008, the neoliberalism, that set of policies, are not simply delivering the way they did when they were created in late 70s, early 80s. You got to understand that creation sometimes called the Thatcherism or Reaganomics or whatever, was a response to the crises of the 1970s. And neoliberalism really restored the American empire, allowed it to expand even further than it did before, along the lines of those four policies. But those policies are not working the way they were. They began breaking down around 2008. And you got to look at Obama and early Trump and Biden as an attempt to put it back together again. But they're having a hard time doing that because the contradictions in fiscal monetary policy are such that it's just not working. And of course, the external policies now with the BRICS and the expansion of the BRICS, that has broken down pretty much conclusively. So what you're seeing is an attempt in this fourth restructuring of American empire, as I call it, you're seeing an attempt to restore neoliberal policies. I don't think they're going to work, but we're in a period of attempt to restore those policies. The big threat to it is the external policies that aren't working anymore. And you see that with the effects of the sanctions and the rise of the BRICS and in the long run decline of the dollar and the international payment system the U.S. uses. So it's in a period of flux and crisis, and it's yet to be determined whether they can restore that group of policies or they have to come up with new policies. We won't know for a couple more years whether that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you real quick, do you think Trump is actually trying to do just that, what you have outlined, to restore the American empire in this neoliberal sense, or do you think he's pursuing something perhaps different?
I think he wants to restore it, whether that is going to be called neoliberal or something else. I don't think he really cares. You know, what he's trying to do is strategically consolidate. That's what Greenland and Panama Canal, that's what that's all about. Consolidate back to the Western Hemisphere, deal with the Pacific, which is really the U.S. interest. Pacific, China, the Western Hemisphere, deal with the BRICS, come up with a way of cooperating and working with the BRICS. If you want a metaphor, think about 1944 Yalta, when Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill, they all got together and they divvied up the world and you had Bretton Woods and a new world order. And what you've got going on now is kind of adrift in that direction. You've got Trump and Putin. China's Xi is going to come to the U.S. pretty soon. So you see a new effort among the power centers.
I would slightly disagree with you because I would suggest that BRICS represents far more than Russia and China. I think it represents a new way of, treating other nations with respect and understanding that, respecting each other's sensibilities and national interests does provide for a more stable world. But unfortunately, we are out of time. We will have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.